Blog Talk Radio.
And welcome to Revolution Radio. This is Wednesday, June 8th, 2011. Welcome, Nancy. Hi there in the chat. Welcome to guests. I'd like to ask a special shout-out to Terry Lakin. Thank you for coming home, and I'm glad that you're home, and I hope you're enjoying it, and you certainly deserve everything. We look forward, I hope, to talking with Terry Lakin as soon as, I guess, everyone else has finished interviewing him. But we're very excited to be able to do that. I'd like to say a shout-out to all of our military and serving and active and so forth. Tonight, we're going to be talking about the 10th Amendment. We have a very good speech by Tom Woods of the 10th Amendment Center. I know that you have one in your state. You should look it up. The one in my state is a city away, but it's still available to get at. And I'd like to begin by talking a couple of things. The reason we're talking about the 10th Amendment tonight is because of the real shift right now to civic action. Nancy, you've been saying out there, stop them cold and arrest the criminals for a long time, and now it's just time to really ratchet up the pressure in whatever way we can do, thinking of creative ways for civic actions on Obama's ineligibility. But in the larger sense, I think what we've seen from all of the action is that our Constitution really has been subverted by the current government. It's not a failure of the American experiment. It's a failure of the people who are serving in government right now. Yeah, we may need to work on a few institutions and so forth, and some amendments may need to come forward at some point when we have this thing under control. But we must go back to the Constitution, and in order to effectively resist, in my view, this encroachment on the government, this rebellion by the government against the people and the Constitution, which is supposed to restrain it, is we need to go back to our 10th Amendment rights, remember where we were when the Constitution started, and really begin to reinvigorate the sovereignty of the states through the grand juries, through the small militias. I think through increased voter scrutiny and so forth. Why, for example, should we have this revolving door between governors, state governors, and the federal government? I don't think that's correct now. I think that we need to have real people who really see the need to protect the states and so forth. Yes, Goat, good evening. It's probably just the three of us. I don't know. You know, it's probably a beautiful evening out there somewhere. It's June, after all. And in any case, you can always catch the archive. But I'd like to start out this evening, before we go into Tom Woods, with a discussion from the book by Martin Babitz, The Illusion of Freedom. Babitz is B-A-B-I-T-Z. I encourage all of you to get this book, The Illusion of Freedom, How to Restore the Constitution and Reclaim Liberty Now. And I'd want to lay out, just in very outline form, essentially the seven truths of the Constitution. Not only my blog has been focusing on this, but I think this is the revolution that we need in our consciousness in order to really find out how to take back our government, not just getting rid of the current representatives and so forth, but really working on the state level and really increasing our responsibility for our own freedom and liberty. So the seven truths of the Constitution. The first truth: limited federal government rather than supreme national government. We've got just the opposite right now. We've got a supreme national government. We don't have limited federal government. The second truth: Republican state government. I believe it's Article 4. We are entitled to, and the federal government shall guarantee to us a Republican state government. That doesn't mean letting Sharia law come in and take over. The third truth: Supreme Court's limited role. What really is the jurisdiction of the Supreme Court? This is a terrific chapter in this book, Illusions of Freedom, Chapter 5, The Supreme Court's Limited Role. The fourth truth: the Bill of Rights restricts the federal government alone. Remember, the Constitution would not have been signed by everyone unless there was guaranteed a Bill of Rights, because the states were very jealous of their own sovereignty, as they should be and as we should be right now. We should be very jealous of that. There have been a number of things that have cut down the state's power, and in fact, what we have seen over time is to really the reduction to try to reduce our sovereignty. Okay, the fifth truth: the Constitution is supreme. The sixth truth: life, liberty, and property get equal Constitution billing. These are the liberty interests, spoken about so eloquently by Commander Kirshner and Mario Apuzzo. Life, liberty, and property get equal constitutional billing. These rights have been violated by this usurpation. Our rights to life, liberty, and property have been violated. And it's not just Obama. There are past usurpations, as you know. Where do you start? Me personally, I picked 1913. The seventh truth, the Constitution guarantees a free enterprise system. It does not allow this switch to socialism or nationalizing industries. It restricts the president. No one can come in and change that. We are guaranteed a right to Republican government. These things are thrown out the window by our representatives. So it is essential that we understand that, number one, it is our civic duty to resist, that we all, as we can, should resist in any way that we can, and that we are now in the process of understanding how we are resisting. Now, on my blog, I did do a piece of a civic action contest, and a lot of ideas came forward, banners, airplanes, so forth and so on. Another idea was just posted on the blog. Go to your employer Monday morning and ask for a 1099 form. Pay your own taxes. Make your own decision that way, vis-a-vis resistance or vis-a-vis whatever you want to do with that. But for example, Obamacare has already ruled unconstitutional that they're still taking money out of your paycheck for Obamacare. Pull it out, say you'll pay it on your own. You get the bill. It lets the employer off the hook. They don't have to pay for that stuff, but it's a 1099, you're on your own. That's the way we should be. We should be on our own here. We don't need our employers acting as federal agencies taking money out of our paychecks, because when we go back to get them, you know, they're not going to blame it on the employers here. So in any case, with those seven truths in mind, I'd like to play for you a speech by Tom Woods. Now, Martin Babbitts, who I just quoted from his book, The Illusion of Freedom, is the head of the 10th Amendment Center, I believe, in New Jersey. I know everyone has one in their state, but we should all get involved, very much so. It is clearly our right, for example, on these eligibility lawsuits or on the eligibility state laws to do this. This is our responsibility. We can do this. The 10th Amendment basically says those rights not reserved to or enumerated to Congress are reserved to the states. So, let me see. Good evening again, Nancy, GOAT, guest. Okay, Council of Ten. Yes, the handpicked governors, one of them is Jan Brewer of Arizona. They're in all the regions. The country has been divided into 10 regions. And I believe that is probably, these people probably can't hold that as a conflict of interest where they are. But this is Obama again. Yes, big liberal state governments to the Council of Ten. That's right. There's nothing in the Constitution on this. So, by GOAT, he left. Well, Nancy, I hope you listen. Anyway, I hope all of you all listen. So tonight we're going with Tom Woods. It's about 60 minutes. I'm going to come back after that and just play a little music. So I've got lots of stuff to do tonight while I'm listening to this broadcast, and I hope it's all right with you. Any last words in there before I come back? See you later. All right. Here we go. Tom Woods, Peace and Liberty, Something for Every American. About 59 minutes.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. I've been up since 4 a.m. your time, so if I get through this at all, it's a minor miracle. But I'm very glad to be here. I think the last time I was in Los Angeles was about 11 years ago, so it's been quite a while. Very glad to be out here, especially because this is the weekend before, like 2 days before, my family and I are taking a two-day trip to get from Topeka, Kansas to Auburn, Alabama. I'm spending a couple months at the Ludwig von Mises Institute over the summer. Right, of course we all know it's the best place in the world, and I'm not even joking, it really is the best place in the world. And of course, you know, we're leaving in a couple of days, so it's in, you know, you have to pack, we have four little kids, you know, under age eight, they're all girls, by the way, and we got to pack for them for 2 months, and on the critical weekend before the trip, well, Tom's got to go to Los Angeles, sorry to my wife, sorry, I mean, it was completely by accident that this event was scheduled, or was it really? Maybe perhaps subconsciously I got the heck out of there. I want to start off talking to you guys by telling you a little something about something I did last year that some of you know about, and I want to reflect on it a bit before getting into any more information, and that is a video that I made that some of you have perhaps seen called Interview with a Zombie. Now, if you have not seen this, I'm going to ask you to do me one personal favor. You guys don't owe me any favors, but if you ever need me to do something, you just give me a call. But go to the website interviewwithazombie.com. Best $7 I ever spent was buying that domain name. Even if you've seen the video, by the way, go to interviewwithazombie.com and you'll also get to see the blooper tape, which is much funnier than the actual video. But the idea, the premise behind Interview with a Zombie is that there's a zombie who has his own television talk show on which he interviews authors. So imagine that, a zombie having his own show. How different that is from our normal television network. So my friend and I, of course, the zombie is played by economist Bob Murphy. He has a PhD from New York University. Super sophisticated guy, but obviously has no self-respect whatsoever. Dresses up as a zombie at the drop of a hat. I didn't even ask him. I just mentioned the idea. I was actually sitting at lunch table with people saying, gosh, I'd love to do this. I had this idea for a skit to talk about nullification. I just need somebody to play the zombie. And Bob is sitting there going, come on. I mean, my gosh, I'd step over my own grandmother for the opportunity to play a zombie, and I don't even know what you're asking me for. So the idea what we came up with was that the zombie would be able to say only one word at a time. So in order to kick off the interview with me, naturally, he holds up the book and says, book. Right, that's right. As you'll see from the blooper tape, the first two times he did this, I could not hold it together. All right, so then I go on explaining what the book is about, and then the idea is that the whole rest of the interview is him throwing these sort of politically correct accusations at me. You know, slavery. And I had to go, no, actually, slavery, nullification was never used to defend slavery, as we saw in the video, right? I mean, even though Rachel Maddow deliberately tries to confuse you, I know, this is a night of surprises, isn't it? Rachel Maddow deliberately tries to confuse you by saying the pro-slavery John C. Calhoun supported nullification. So, of course, you know what that means. It's all about slavery. Well, of course, what would the southern states have needed nullification for with regard to slavery? What anti-slavery laws would they have needed to nullify? Like, the argument doesn't even make any sense. All right, so I go on and explain to the zombie that it was never used to defend slavery, and it was in fact used to fight against the fugitive slave laws. And isn't that neat? I'm going to put these here. If I forget them, somebody remind me. My glasses are down here. So after I answer that objection, he then moves on to another objection. Well, racism. I bet nobody in this room has ever been accused of racism because you support the powers of the state against the federal government, right? But nobody never heard of it. But that's the zombie's argument. So again, I have to explain this. No, obviously there's no necessary connection between these things, no logical connection. And then it just goes on, and then he just starts recycling the words that I've already addressed. He just goes back to it. So the point is, he has no substantive argument. The idea is just to smear me out of existence, to use these magic words that throw you out of the discussion entirely, that toxify you, that make you radioactive in our society. But every single time he makes an argument, so to speak, or utters a word, I've got all these facts and substantive responses, and it doesn't matter. You make no progress with the zombie. Now, the point of the video should be obvious, that if I were to go on with, you know, Rachel Maddow or Chris Matthews or any of these people, the experience I would have would be exactly like what I had with the zombie, except they wouldn't have the excuse of actually being a zombie. In fact, you know, on YouTube, you can type in zombie and stuff, and you can find funny videos about what to do if zombies take over America. And my question is, how would we tell the difference? All right. So that was a promo for Nullification. And it's got, like, you know, a whole bunch of views, like people viewing this thing. People have supported it quite a bit. I was very happy about that. But it's making a larger point here. I mean, ha, 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 but it's making a larger point. First, strategically, it helped, because before people could smear me with those words, I'm already laughing at them. So that now when they do try to smear me, well, then all my friends just go on their blogs, and in the comments section, they link to the zombie video. So it's great. $7! Plus, you know, I mean, people did help me out with the video and so on, but that was really great for me in that it made it easier to push an idea that is totally out of the so-called mainstream. And secondly, this idea of the mainstream or extremism, we get this all the time. My goodness, you people are extremists. Because you think that if the federal government violates the Constitution, that maybe we shouldn't do that thing. And this is extremism. And extremism is another one of these words that's used to shut down discussion. I mean, what, you want to be an extremist? What's wrong with you? No. You want to be in the mainstream. The mainstream runs from Hillary Clinton to Mitt Romney. So it's about a 3-inch area, pretty much. Like this, from right here to like here. That's where you want to be. And of course, the point of the video is that in our society, if you want to talk about a real substantive issue, that alone makes you an extremist. Because if you were part of the mainstream, you'd be satisfied with the completely trivial issues they want us to talk about. Should the top marginal tax rate be 39.5 or 35%? Which one should it be? Which of two possible ways should the federal government loot us every year? You know, they could loot us by taking this part of our property, or they could loot us by taking another part. Discuss. But, you know, but those of us who say, you know what, I don't like the way the deck is being stacked in these. I find these questions completely creepy and totally beside the point. How do you answer that question if you don't happen to like being expropriated in the first place? There is no answer for you. You're an extremist. Ooh, ooh, ooh. An extremist just means you disagree with both Hillary Clinton and Mitt Romney. That's all it means. It's an attempt to shut down debate. And the way you respond to that is, first of all, of course, by refusing to be intimidated. And secondly, by laughing at them. Oh, man, have I had a blast with this zombie thing. Because now all these people who come after me, now they all have to say, now, wait a minute, I'm not being a zombie here. Now, just wait one second. The fact that they even have to say this is a great victory. Moreover, if we're ever discouraged in this battle, just remember, and if you haven't seen it, you can go to YouTube and find it. Remember the beauty of the look on Chris Matthews' face on MSNBC when the subject of nullification came up. I mean, it was like the return of Godzilla to this guy. Just that look of sheer terror that maybe, just maybe, an idea that the mainstream has not approved for us, the mainstream media, the mainstream political class has not approved for us in advance, is taking root anyway. Maybe they are losing their domination over our minds. This led him to this expression of sheer terror. Yeah, it's about time. I made the terrible mistake of abandoning my water. I'm extremely dehydrated today, so I'm going to take a little break here. Talk amongst yourselves. I'll give you a topic. I forgot to give you a topic. Yeah, right. The whole discussion could be one word. All right, just very quickly, because a lot of you already know this, so I'm going to go the quick, let's see if I can do this in 3 minutes. Not the whole rest of the talk. no such luck. But the 3-minute overview of nullification. You ready? Because we all basically have the gist of this, but I want to give it, you know, a full formal presentation. Here we go. Here's the idea behind state nullification. First, as we saw in that video, which of course stole half of my remarks, thank you, John Bush and Jason Rink for nothing. It comes from Thomas Jefferson, and even before that, it comes from the state ratifying convention of Richmond, Virginia, in 1788. And I talk about this in the book Nullification. Now, even if you don't know what nullification is, you see a book that has the word nullification stamped over the faces of Obama, Pelosi, and Harry Reid, you say, well, whatever this thing is, I think I'm probably in favor. In 1798, Jefferson and Madison draft the Kentucky and Virginia resolutions, respectively. In these resolutions, we see it spelled out what the powers of the states are in situations like this, when the state is responding to a federal law that violates the Constitution, or a federal measure that violates the Constitution. What should the state do? Well, the state should refuse to enforce this. And I give evidence that, you know, there is good constitutional grounds for believing this, and I won't go into all this tonight because I'm doing this in the quick version, but the bottom line of this is that Jefferson said that nullification is the rightful remedy, and James Madison said that the parties to the Constitution, he said this in his famous report of 1800, in the last resort have got to have some way to check the federal government when all three branches betray us, even the holy judicial branch, which is supposed to be infallible, and once the judges have spoken, we're all supposed to bow down and shut our mouths. Even then, says Madison, we need to be able to resist. Madison said in the Virginia Resolutions of 1798 that the states were duty-bound to resist when the federal government violated the Constitution. Now, later on in his life, he said different things. And so people say, aha, well, in 1830, when he was 103, he changed his mind or whatever. I addressed that on pages 288 to 290, so I'm going to leave you with that. But when we talk about this, the logic of it basically runs as follows. Just a few steps. Number one, in the American system, no government is conceived of as being sovereign. And by sovereign, I mean having ultimate decision-making power. We sometimes talk about state sovereignty, but that's just shorthand for the sovereignty of the peoples of the states. No government is sovereign. That's the old world European model that Americans fled from. It's the peoples of the states who are sovereign. And in their sovereign capacity, they apportion powers between the state governments and the federal government. And in so doing, they don't give up their sovereignty. They are merely exercising their sovereignty. They retain ultimate decision-making power. So if the agent that they themselves created, namely the federal government, should go beyond the powers granted to it by the sovereign peoples of the state, then the very logic of the system demands that the sovereign peoples of the state, by virtue of being sovereign, have to have a last resort mechanism for intervening when their own system perverts its instrument, namely the Constitution. That's the logic of it. So it doesn't matter that a bunch of, you know, that the Supreme Court, you know, once or twice has said, hey, you're not allowed to do this. That's totally beside the point. The point is that the logic of the system demands it. The system makes no sense otherwise. And that's what I'm elaborating on in the book and in some of my other stuff. Okay, so that's kind of my... I did it! Ha! I did it. 3 minutes. Okay. The federal government, said Jefferson, cannot have a monopoly on determining what its own powers are, because we all know what it's going to do. It's going to suddenly determine that it has more and more and more and more and more powers. It's going to keep on discovering these vast, untapped reservoirs of power. We all know this. I mean, this has happened. It's not like I'm talking theory up here. Just look around, look at the Constitution, then look at what we live under. This is what has happened. So it's not enough to say, well, gee, you know, it would be nice if they would listen to the Constitution, then the government would be more limited. Yes, it would be nice. A lot of things would be nice. But power has to counteract power. You can't expect the Tenth Amendment to enforce itself. the states have to assert themselves. That's the idea behind state nullification. That maybe there aren't going to be national solutions to the problems we're facing. Maybe they have to be bottom-up instead of top-down solutions. Maybe. Maybe we're just feeding a monster when we keep looking for national solutions. Now, having said this, the constitutional arguments that have been raised against nullification, I take on here, and so I won't tire you with those. And what I'm trying to do is to recover some lost U.S. history. I mean, to learn about what the states used to get away with against the federal government is incredible. I mean, the federal government has spent at least the past century enjoying itself at our expense, enjoying all the things that it can get away with at our expense. That's why it's so enjoyable and cathartic to see what the states were doing in the name of freedom against the federal government. But having said that, I want to emphasize that the fact that a crummy law violates the Constitution, well, you know, that's bad, and I'm sorry about that, and I'm against that. But the real problem is that the law is evil and immoral in the first place, Constitution or not. And we have to focus on it, because oftentimes we get bogged down with focus. I mean, and the Constitution, that's great. If the Constitution is an argument that you can appeal to with your friends to get them to agree with you about limiting government, you know, you have my blessing, let's go use it. But ultimately, it's a question of right and wrong, good and evil. And it's, oh, okay. Now, of course, as I indicated at the beginning, we're not allowed to have these thoughts, citizen. You understand that? We're not allowed to have these thoughts. Confine yourselves to the range of debate that is allowed to you on the pages of the New York Times. That is, we, your overlords, will determine for you the range of allowable debate. We will determine for you. How dare you uppity people think you have some voice in determining the range of debate? That's been the attitude. And so we have this problem of thought controllers in our society who use demonizing, toxifying words like extremism, or they introduce slavery to scare people away when it has, not only does it have zero to do with nullification, it's exactly the opposite. When South Carolina seceded from the Union, December 20th, 1860, one of its complaints was that the North was nullifying the fugitive slave law. Now, that's the opposite of what every school kid thinks he knows about nullification, if he's even been taught what the word means. We're not allowed to have these thoughts. No, 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 citizens. And yet, what does this mean? What does it mean when they call us extremists? Well, you notice what they don't use the word extremism for. They don't use it to describe what the federal government does. You never hear the thought controllers, and when I say thought controllers, I'm thinking about, you know, the MSNBCs, even the Fox News sometimes. I'm thinking about Media Matters, you know, this left-wing media watchdog group that monitors all television to make sure nobody utters an unapproved thought. I'm thinking about the misnamed website Think Progress, which, I mean, I think of it as more like Think Zombie, or because it's bankrolled by George Soros, Think Soros is another possibility. But notice that it is not considered to be extremism when the TSA is sticking its hands down our pants. Nothing extreme about that. That's just public policy, citizen. Shut your mouth. So that's not extremism. By definition, it's not, because it falls between Hillary and Mitt. So how could it be extreme, right? These are the great statesmen of our day. They're going to be remembered for centuries and centuries on. You know, there'll be a Plutarch someday who will write the lives of these people. Or how about the fact that our entitlement programs are underfunded by an amount more than double the GDP of the entire world? You and I didn't do that. That wasn't our policy. That's the mainstream. That's the non-extreme people. No, you and I are the extreme ones. You and I are the ones who say, now, whoa, 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 I'm pretty sure you're not going to be able to pay that off. Now, come on now. Now, listen. My gosh. Now, I don't want to make this all about myself, but I am going to share a little something about my experiences. I, of course, when, you know, you write a book called Nullification, and you're talking about the powers of the state, you know what's going to happen to you, okay? I knew this going into it. I knew I was going to be called all kinds of names, and people were going to accuse me of having bad motives, and I'm a bad guy, and I just want to impress people. Yeah, because the best strategy for oppressing people is first try the almost insuperable task of resurrecting a completely toxified historical concept called nullification. First try to do that. Then get it accepted over the heads of all the media people in the whole country and against the entire political class. Then go to step two. Yeah, that seems like the most effective way. I mean, it doesn't even make sense even if that were what I was doing. But I knew this was going to happen, and there's no way to disprove this. Because they're going to, you know, they can read my mind and they know what I'm really up to and so on. And so, you know, I've been called some rotten names and I've had some terrible attacks on me, and it's made me thicker skin, but more importantly, the experience has actually made me a better person. Literally, in the sense that, for one thing, and I'll be honest with you, I used to, when I was younger and I would write stuff, I would criticize books I hadn't even read. Because, you know, I knew the author was a jerk, and I'd heard about the book, so it's probably stupid and whatever. Now, come on now, let's be honest. You're going to tell me you have never criticized a book you haven't read? I mean, come on. Like, everybody read Al Gore's book, Earth and the Balance? Come on. We have all done this. And they did it to me. Not just with this book, but with other ones. They did it to me. They said terrible things about me. They sometimes said the opposite of things that I said. The complete opposite. So they obviously hadn't read it. And I just decided at that moment, I'm not doing this anymore. I mean, they can treat me this way, and they can act like this, but I'm not going to be like this anymore. I'm not going to treat people like garbage. I'm not going to refuse to give them the courtesy of, you know, I mean, look, it's a huge, huge, unbelievable undertaking to write a book. I mean, you at least owe the author that you at least read his thing before you go out and... So I'm not doing that anymore. I'm not going to criticize somebody on the basis of two or three totally uncharacteristic quotations from 15 years ago, as if that's who this person is. I'm not doing that with people anymore. I used to do that, and that's childish and pathetic, and I'm not going to be that person. And that's what I learned from having gone through this, that, yeah, they're going to keep doing that to me. But at least I can live well and I can sleep at night. And this has been an important experience for me. And I will say also that some of the attacks on me have been so vicious and so high profile that it occurred to me years ago that it was very likely that at some point, and I'm saying this not to get sympathy, but it occurred to me that at some point probably they would get to be so great that I would basically be abandoned. That basically people would say, this guy's too much of a liability, we got to just move on. And I would have been okay with that. You know, I mean, I did my duty as I saw it, and I would have been okay with that. And yet it hasn't happened, because everyone has stuck by me, and I want to thank you. Now, what's interesting about the thought controllers is that... I mean, many of the thought controllers are on the left. I mean, I'll, in my opinion. But what genuine progressive really thinks Joe Biden is anything other than a shill for the establishment? I mean, come on. Right? A real progressive dislikes Joe Biden as much as we do. A real progressive would be opposed, as a constitutionalist is, to the Patriot Act, to the misuse of the National Guard, to the unconstitutional interference with the use of medical marijuana. And incidentally, when that case went before the Supreme Court, it was three of the most conservative states in the Union that stood with Angel Raich on that issue. It was Alabama, Mississippi, and Louisiana. And now, you know, listen, I wouldn't want to be caught with a joint in Alabama. But their argument was, yeah, we don't like California's law, but that's what a federal system is, you know? It's not some kind of nationalist nightmare where there's one policy and we're just going to shove it down your throat. No, it's live and let live. So what if Alabama is different from California? Good. Okay, good. So what if Vermont is different from Idaho? So what? That's what America is. So a progressive would support, the old style progressive in the new left tradition believes small is beautiful. And that meant not just business enterprise, but it meant also political units, that it's dehumanizing to have 309 million people being infallibly governed by one city. This is insane, and yet no one can even question that. Because if you question that, you're an extremist, because Hillary doesn't question that. Mitt Romney doesn't question that. Don't ask this question, citizen. And there goes small is beautiful. What happened to small is beautiful? Is 309 million people small? Is that the exact right coming down from heaven scale of political order? 309 million to one? Is that how it works? Or how about what the TSA does to us? How about them sticking their hands down our pants? Or you have to worry about, if I'm going to travel with children, I either have my kid irradiated or groped. This is a choice they're giving us. There's no progressive worth his salt that would disagree with that. And yet, why have so few of them stood with us? Why have so few of them said, no, this is so bad that, yes, we're even willing to stand with some of these Tenth Amendment people? I mean, the TSA is even worse than that. At least the Tenth Amendment people aren't sticking their hands down my pants. That's one thing I can say for them. Where are they? They're nationalists. They are stuck in the nationalist mold. Every issue has one solution. And if you dissent from that, if you are a dissident, well, you know the words they'll use. Now, they claim that the reason they won't stand with us is they're so concerned about the fate of minorities. They're just deeply concerned. They're always losing sleep about this and so on and so forth because they're such humanitarian. Now, I will take them at their word because I do believe there are people of goodwill who are being honest, who genuinely are concerned that there could be violations of civil rights at the state and local level. So I don't want to make light of that. That can be a genuine concern. And I stand up here as somebody who holds no brief for the state, per se. The states are run by insane sociopaths half the time, too. Which is precisely why I favor nullification, because at least we can put them to some good use, have them do something for us. But when we think back about, you know, people will say, well, in the civil rights movement, didn't they use nullification rhetoric? And, of course, yes, they did. They did use nullification rhetoric. But there are a couple things to remember here. Now, again, first, as somebody who I describe myself as a libertarian, I look at what was going on in the southern states in the 1950s, and I see a state offense against human dignity. Because look at what was going on. Remember the Rosa Parks episode, of course. Now, Rosa Parks, we all remember the bus boycott. But in 1943, an episode most people don't remember, Rosa Parks, let's remember, by the way, that when we say blacks had to sit at the back of the bus, it wasn't that you would get on the bus and then you would walk toward the back. You'd get on the bus, put your coin in, then get back out, and then go to the back door and get in. So Rosa Parks one day, it's a rainy day, she gets in, she puts her coin in, she gets back out, goes to the back, and the bus drives away. So it's not enough that she has to live under this. Now they have to treat her like an animal. So then, in the mid-50s, now she has her opportunity. She gets on board the bus on that fateful day. It's the same bus driver who left her in the rain 12 years earlier. So now, of course, the argument is, well, I mean, this is a, you know, this city bus monopoly and these ordinances are, you know, state enterprises. I mean, it seems like we're entitled to being treated with dignity here. And when they boycott the buses, they're trying to think of alternative ways to arrange transportation. So, all right, some people will take people in their cars. And then there's an attempt to crack down on that because you don't have a license to do that, to cart people around. So, again, it's a state of, I mean, what are these people supposed to do? So I think it's entirely right to have sympathy. So it's not, people think, well, you just don't care what was going on. I do care. But what was the remedy in that situation? Like, how did they get in that situation? And the answer, of course, is that it wasn't the court cases that turned things around. The court cases did not turn things around. Yeah, there were some mild consequences. The thing that turned things around was when the 15th Amendment began to be enforced with the Voting Rights Act of 1965. Then suddenly, a lot of these problems began to go away. So to compare 2011 with Birmingham 1963 is not fair, and it's not a reasonable comparison. In the same way that the neoconservatives think every single second is Munich 1938, the progressives think it's always Birmingham 1963. It's not. And for 30 years, blacks have been moving to the South in huge numbers. Things are completely different today. So it is wrong of them to cite this. And again, as I noted in that documentary, think of what the most lethal institution in the world for minorities has been. And it's not decentralized power or a federal system. Now, ever since Thomas Hobbes, in his book Leviathan, we have been taught that the way human beings have to organize themselves politically is in one irresistible power center, and there is no subsidiary body in society that has any prior liberties that cannot be abridged or canceled by that central authority. This is the starting point for political organization in the Western world, certainly since the French Revolution. And we think that's the only way to live, right? You can't have one area doing something different from another area. You can't have institutions within a larger institution that have liberties of their own. But that's exactly how European society was organized until basically the 17th or 18th centuries. There were multiple power centers, and that's what allowed society to avoid totalitarianism. If you had had a Hitler or Stalin in the 17th century, they could not have done the damage they did. As murderous as they were, they wouldn't have had the authority to do it because they were much too hemmed in by competing power centers. When we hear all these titles that kings had centuries ago, he's the king of so-and-so and the protector of this, and that wasn't because he was vain. That was a recognition that there were bodies under his care that preceded him, that had liberties that came before his prerogatives, and that he was bound to respect. We don't have that anymore. That's all gone. Now what we have is there's one single flat plane, there's no subsidiary body that can stand up to the center. And what have the results been? Have the results been fantastic bouts of liberty breaking out everywhere around the world? Or has it been totalitarian revolutions, total war, unpayable debts, crushing burdens, growing bureaucracies? I mean, you know, I think the question answers itself. And yet, the misnamed progressives look at this structure and say, yep, that's the best and only way to organize society, and anyone who dissents from that must be some kind of an extremist. These are the people who had the nerve to use the expression question authority. When was the last time these people questioned anything they were saying? Anything. Now look, there are a lot of reasons. There are a lot of reasons that we might all be here. Some people might be here out of a devotion to the cause of health freedom in various forms, whether it's freedom from the so-called Obamacare. I hate that word, by the way. Various other forms of health freedom. There could be people who are devoted to the 10th Amendment to the Constitution. There could be people who are just dedicated to the principle that it's better for there to be multiple power centers in society, for people to have greater voice in the regime they live under, whatever. There are all different reasons. But I want to spend my last few moments just sharing with you what my own are. And my own, basically, are both domestic and foreign. Domestically, I've come to the conclusion that the federal government has sold us a bill of goods, and they've brainwashed us into believing it. Ever since we were sitting in their crummy schools, they fed us this line that without them, we'd be totally lost, we'd be pathetic boobs, we'd all be eating poison food, we would, with all our technological advances, we wouldn't have thought of any way to come up with a non-lethal sandwich. Our kids would all be working in a mine for a dollar a day, we'd all be getting our limbs blown off because our computer monitors would be exploding. Everybody would earn 3 cents an hour, there'd be no science, there'd be no art, and on and on and on, right? You know, everybody would be an ignoramus, and this and that, right? I mean, everybody was taught this. I understand why people believe this. There's a superficial plausibility to it, because you say, well, before we had a lot of government intervention, people lived in terrible conditions, now they live in better conditions, so the one must have caused the other. That's completely illegitimate reasoning, and I think I could try to demonstrate that in my newer book, Rollback. But the point is that if we were educated in, this is my new analogy, I'm kind of fond of, I'm very bad at analogies. I'm the anti-Peter Schiff when it comes to analogies. I'm so bad at it. He thinks of analogies in his sleep, you know, he can be drunk. you know, in car accidents, coming up with analogies. I can't think of anything. But imagine you were educated in Walmart schools, schools run and funded by Walmart. Well, the kids, now, I suppose in these schools, every day the kid goes to this classroom, and the classroom up on the wall is all pictures of Walmart CEOs looking down upon the kids wisely. And the kids are taught to sing songs, oh, how great the Walmart CEOs are. Oh, God bless the Walmart CEOs. We'd all be pathetic boobs without them. So on and on and on, they cut out little pictures of the Walmart CEOs. And then one day a year, they get to stay home from school and meditate on the great contributions of the Walmart CEOs, whatever. Wouldn't we, in that situation, wouldn't we say, now that's a little bit creepy, you know, like, I mean, come on. I mean, maybe there were a couple of good Walmart CEOs, but I mean, I refuse to believe that all good things in civilization came from these people. Like, we would say that. Yet, when it's U.S. presidents up on that wall, we accept everything they say. Oh, gosh, heaven forbid. What kind of a caveman are you? You mean you don't want the great innovations of President so-and-so? Where would we be? We'd all be dead in a ditch and have no limbs. And things like that. I mean, it's like a mental disorder. And like somehow it's been talked to. I don't know how. It's an incredible racket. It is an unbelievable racket. I mean, in a way, I almost wish I was clever enough to have thought of it. That I would loot you people. I would loot and expropriate you people. And then to add insult to injury, I would train your kids to cheer what I'm doing. I mean, man, I mean, that is serious, serious sociopathic cleverness. How do they think of this stuff? So I don't believe it. I believe this institution has held back human progress. I believe it pits us all against each other in a civil war of everybody grabbing. And every one of us has been sucked into some kind of interest group, whether it's our occupation or our age or our race or our class. Everybody wants to grab and grab and grab and grab. It's what Frederick Bastiat said. The state is the great fiction by which everyone attempts to live at the expense of everyone else. And look at where it's got. However, my last section here is something that maybe not all of you are going to receive well, but, you know, I gotta be me, you know, okay? I gotta tell you. And the other thing is, so in other words, because of this, I believe this institution is like a de-civilization agent. So at every turn, I want to try and stop it. And if this is a tool for doing it, then I'm all for it. But it's worse than that because, you know, let me start off by saying, giving my right-wing credentials here. I was the vice president of the Harvard College Republicans. I know you're all thinking, yeah, that's some right-wing credential. Wow, so you supported Walter Mondale? Great. Okay, the older crowd remembers Walter Mondale. Good, that joke wasn't lost on me. Okay, my Politically Incorrect Guide to American History is one of the best-selling books in the history of the conservative book club. I mean, like, so I'm not a commie. I'm not a, you know, pinko or anything like that. I'm the least commie guy you'll ever meet, although there are a lot of pretty non-commie people in this room, I'll say, of course. But having said that, I also came to the conclusion that I don't believe the foreign policy either. I just don't believe them. I don't believe a word of it. And I say this to people knowing, again, that some of you are going to disagree with me, but I'm telling you I'm not a leftist in any way, and I came to the conclusion that they're lying sociopaths domestically, and they don't magically transform into angelic beings when it comes to foreign policy. They're also lying to us big. Now, that's not to say that there aren't some nasty people around the world. I mean, there's no need to caricature what I'm saying. But I think back to the 1990s when I was, you know, well, younger than I am now, and I basically believe that, well, I'm a good little conservative, and so, you know, when the authorities tell me that military action is necessary, only a pinko commie would question that. Now, that was a big, big moral mistake I made, an intellectual mistake, and I'm sorry I made it. And I think back to the disgraceful ways I used to make up excuses for these people. They would commit horrific atrocities. And they would do it on the most flimsy pretext. I mean, the arguments they made for some of these wars were so transparent. I thought, how can a conservative, really, who's supposed to be dedicated to Western civilization and reason and on, be swept up in this? I mean, it's so beneath us to fall for some of this stuff. And yet I fell for it, and I would go around searching for corroborating evidence to support their lies. And if I had seen a poor Russian in the Soviet Union doing the same thing, saying, oh no, saying to his neighbors, no, 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 what Pravda is telling us is true. Look, I've been looking it up, and I look at all this evidence I found. I would have treated that person with contempt. But for some reason, when it was my looting expropriators, it was okay for me to make excuses for them and to search out corroborating evidence for arguments that they had abandoned. They themselves had, they weren't even making these arguments anymore, and I was still looking for ways to defend them. And I finally just decided, and this was back in the early 1990s, after the first Persian Gulf War. Now, this is a war a lot of people thought was just, nothing wrong with it, you know, Saddam's a bad guy, massing his troops on the Saudi border, and so on and on. But I remember hearing about people, hundreds of thousands of people retreating, being incinerated, and I'm being asked to have a Bob Hope special to celebrate this. Some backward country, some backwater, which actually by regional standards was relatively advanced, hardly. But relatively speaking, a modern healthcare system and so on and so forth. So I thought to myself, what's happening to me? What have I allowed this institution to do to me that I could look so callously on these poor people? I don't care if they were conscripted into an army. They were conscripted, most of them, and I don't care that the sociopaths in D.C. have told me I'm supposed to hate these people, because I don't hate them. And when I saw that I was supposed to, if there had been an earthquake over there, we would all be tears and pity about it. But when they're incinerated alive, nothing. These people are human garbage. And I just decided at that point, I'm not doing this anymore. I don't believe what you people are telling me. I don't believe your phony baloney reasons for your wars, that all you care about is democracy, so that therefore you can put the emir of Kuwait back on his throne. I mean, come on. You know, I'm not 7 years old. In fact, that's an insult, because my 7-year-old is smarter than that. I have sometimes said, by the way, that I managed to explain to my 7-year-old what nullification meant. And it made me conclude that a panel of 7-year-olds would be better than the Supreme Court and the Federal Reserve Board put together. So let me finish, because I know I'm way over. But also, as the 1990s progressed, okay, so then we've got the sanctions regime on Saddam. And the UN, okay, we don't like the UN, neither do I. The UN says 500,000 children have died of malnutrition because of the sanctions. And then the usual response is, well, that's a phony statistic, or if Saddam hadn't spent all his money on palaces, the kids could have eaten or whatever. That's neither here nor there. The point is, U.S. officials, Madeleine Albright and Bill Richardson, both said they did not question that figure. They said that price was worth it. They didn't say the UN is lying. They didn't say this is awful. They said that price is worth it. Now, I am sorry. There is impossible for a conservative who lectures the world about moral relativism to say, I mean, what? We are better than this. How can we allow ourselves to be so dehumanized that we sit here and allow ourselves to be called extremists when people who make excuses for the killing of 500,000 children to go about their business and we defend this? This is public policy. No! I can't do this! Incidentally, Russell Kirk is considered by some to be the founder of modern American conservatism. His classic book, The Conservative Mind, is probably in like a 9th edition by now. A very significant figure. And when we look at Kirk's foreign policy, it has nothing in common with the teenage laptop bombardiers who run our foreign policy today. It has nothing to do with the neocon Bill Kristol, nothing. You look at Russell Kirk, who's a real conservative, who hasn't had his brain washed by these phonies on the radio. Kirk said that military conscription is akin to slavery. This is the most significant conservative figure of the 20th century. In his book, 1954, called A Program for Conservatives, he laid out a foreign policy that bears zero resemblance to the interventionism that we have now. And at the end of the Persian Gulf War, he said that George H.W. Bush, now this is the most significant conservative thinker of the 20th century, He said George H.W. Bush should be strung up on the White House lawn for war crimes. Was he a pinko commie, Russell Kirk? Is that what we're going to, is that what we're reduced to? No. Now, finally, therefore, my conclusion is, it is not enough to say that in Washington we've got some bumblers and, boy, they're inefficient. And there are some libertarians who sort of take that tack, that, gosh, you know, government's just full of these people who have, they have these programs with all these crazy unintended consequences. What a bunch of jokers. I don't go for that. It's not that they're jokers. It's that they are raving sociopaths whom I don't want have exercising any power over me. If we, in our own community, if we can't solve our problems face-to-face with each other without the intervention of these people, then heaven help us. The states, but especially these modern mega-states, have been a moral and material disaster. Now, being here and, of course, you know, in this type of room, there are people of all different points of view. And sometimes people wonder, you know, well, maybe there are some people on the left who are so disaffected on some critical issues that maybe they'll join with us. And in some areas, and here I am, I'm the squariest of the square. I've never smoked pot. I've never done any of this stuff. I got four kids. I got a minivan. You know, I'm not part of it. But I feel like I have more in common with somebody like, in the 60s, a Carl Oglesby, who says that the old right, which is the right wing that I've talked about that's been totally decimated, and the new left are in many ways morally and politically coordinated. I'm sympathetic to the new left historian William Appleman Williams, who said that the best approximation we ever came in this country to having truly humane communities was under the Articles of Confederation. Now, you utter these words, you say something like that to Bill Kristol, you may as well be holding a crucifix in front of Dracula. Now, are there alliances that are possible? Maybe. I mean, I did a book that I've got out there with a friend Murray Polner, and he and I disagree on almost everything, but on critical things, we came together and we produced, I think, a nice little product. I don't know what types of alliances are possible. All we can do is to hold aloft the banner of justice and humanity and see who rallies to it. And no matter who joins us, fight we must. For as Ludwig von Mises said, everyone carries a part of society on his shoulders. No one is relieved of his share of responsibility by others. And no one can find a safe way out for himself if society is sweeping toward destruction. Therefore, everyone, in his own interests, must thrust himself vigorously into the intellectual battle. None can stand aside with unconcern. The interest of everyone hangs on the result. Let's all stand together. Thank you very much.
Bye. Here's a song that was written for us by Hugh Masekela. He calls it Soweto Blues.
Blue. Bendy Poopy. abrieron camino a la aventura. En cada esquina una memoria inolvidable.